Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by Cooker, spelt quicker, pronounced Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water direct to your kitchen tap. Today is a revisit special. It's a podcast from yesteryear. It's we're going to replay a podcast that we loved. Today we're going to be replaying the conversation I had with Will Storr. Now, Will Storr is a fascinating guy. I thoroughly enjoyed his book. He had a book out at the time when we interviewed him called Selfie, which is not about taking pictures of yourself. Well, it kind of indirectly is, but it's about our self-obsession. There's some talk about Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, and there is a whole discussion on how the East and the West are different. Why we're feeling a little bit miserable about our lives. There's a lot of that in there. And potentially where we're going wrong. I found the whole conversation fascinating, but I find most of my conversations fascinating. And I really do like his book. And what I do like about his book is it comes in like a silver cover.
So you can look at yourself. Have you? Please tell me.
I just got it.
How long have you had that book?
Oh, God, this is a good couple of years now, I think. That was lost on me, wasn't it?
You really, really amaze me sometimes. On a serious note, I remember that there's a few that we've done that have really stuck in my head, and I remember this one being one of those. I love this episode.
And the great thing about this is you'll be able to take stuff that Will Storr says, go down the pub, or when you're hanging out at a dinner party, or wherever you're going. You'll be able to quote him constantly.
And you can use the word neoliberalism.
Ah, that is interesting. Okay, let's hear from him. This is Will Storr.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, write into Dear Lovejoy.
Will, welcome to the podcast. Before we get stuck into your book, first of all, tell us a bit about yourself.
I'm a writer. I write books. I write journalism. And that's about it.
Okay. So this new book, Selfie, why did you decide to write the book?
Well, it came out of sort of my journalism. I was doing a story sort of 4 or 5 years ago about this famous American psychologist called Roy Baumeister. And he was this guy who, he took on this sort of idea that having high self-esteem is really good for you, which I was brought up with that idea. I kind of completely believe that idea. And he proved that it was sort of largely nonsense. And, when I was talking to people, I was like, did you know that, that whole self-esteem thing is rubbish? And they would go, no, it's not, is it? And I was like, yeah, it's rubbish. And then, so that was really interesting. Like, there was this sort of big idea that was out there that we all kind of just unquestioningly believe. And then I found out, sort of doing my reporting for the story, that a big part of why we believe it is down to this one guy called John Vasconcellos, this sort of amazingly kind of weird American kind of politician back in the 80s. And I just thought, that's extraordinary. So just that there's this guy that had this idea, it changed everything. So that's when I kind of thought, well, maybe there's a book here, because it felt like a big story, you know, that had my sort of journalistic antenna kind of twitching.
Okay, before we go back to that though, we'll go back to that in a minute. Before we go into that though, the book looks like it took a long time to write. You did a bit of traveling, you met a lot of people. How long was the process?
About 3 years. It was 3 years of pretty solid work on it. So it was a much bigger undertaking than I thought it was going to be. Like, it started off just with that high self-esteem idea, but then it became just a much bigger thing.
So tell us some of the experiences you had, because you had some quite... You went and did quite a bit of stuff, didn't you? You got involved.
Yeah. Well, that's what I like to do. That's sort of part of my kind of shtick, really. I sort of get out there and get stuck into stuff. So what I wanted to do was kind of explain kind of who we are today. Who are we today in the West? You know, like, what is the Western self? You know, we're in this kind of place now where we're all kind of under pressure to be a certain kind of person, like extrovert, thin, like, and it's like, why? So I wanted to sort of set about on this journey of discovering the journey of the Western self, who, you know, how did it all come to be? And that meant, well, you know, that meant kind of trying to travel in time, really. And of course, that's hard because you can't travel in time. So I had to find ways of you know, finding out. So, for example, who were we 1,000 years ago in the dark, you know, in medieval times? So for that, I went to this medieval monastery called Pluscarden in sort of the north of Scotland, where all these Benedictine monks are still living as they did sort of hundreds of years ago. So we're there for a week. That was pretty intense. And then, you know, to find out who we were kind of in the 60s and 70s, I went to this place called the Esalen Institute, which is sort of a very famous kind of retreat center for kind of finding yourself that everybody was going to back in the 60s and 70s. It's where Don Draper from Mad Men ends up at the sort of end of the very last episode. So it's a very influential place. And again, they're still living there pretty much as, you know, pretty much as they were living kind of in the 60s or 70s in terms of their ideas of who we ought to be. So it was almost like sort of time travel, really. I was trying to like find places where, you know, people were living as we did years ago.
Did any of it work?
Any of it work? I mean, I think, yeah, every, in the sense that every stage of the journey taught me something new about, you know, the Western self, taught me something new about, you know, who we are today. So, for example, back at, you know, in the medieval monastery, it was interesting because, you know, really my journey begins in ancient Greece. You know, that's the beginning of the Western self. That's where we became individualists and interested in kind of self-improvement. And it was interesting to find in that very Christian place evidence of sort of ancient Greece everywhere, kind of wherever you look at it. For example, you know, one of the ideas that kind of came about in ancient Greece, which is still so powerful on us today, they called it kalokagathia. And that's this idea that you can judge somebody's inner worth by the state of their physical bodies. So you look at somebody and if they look great, they're a good person.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just on the first night in the monastery sort of lying there looking up, and there was this crucifix on the wall, and there was Jesus hanging on the crucifix, and he was gorgeous. He was like a Love Island contestant, you know. He was, you know, and I thought, God, that is so Greek, you know. Yeah. You can see the kind of the Greek influences there. It was really interesting to when you sort of know what to look for. You know, he's got, even had that kind of pelvic V line that you get on the front of Men's Health Today, and you got, you know, on a statue of you know, a Greek god, but 2,500 years ago. So that, it was just really interesting to find. You can see kind of relics of this journey as you sort of move through the story. It was kind of really fascinating.
Okay, so you expect the book to be sort of lighthearted is not the right word, but it's pretty serious stuff, this, isn't it? Because you just assume self-esteem is a good thing. You assume looking at yourself and working on yourself is good, but the serious side to it is suicide rates are off the scale at the moment, aren't they? They're growing, and do you believe it's because of this obsession we have with ourselves?
Well, there are lots of different indications in the environment that things are going pretty badly wrong. I mean, what's growing is suicidal ideation. That's people thinking about, you know, killing themselves. Self-harm is growing. Body dysmorphia is growing. Eating disorders are growing. So there's lots of things that are kind of going wrong, you know, particularly for young people. And so when I spoke to this guy, Gordon Flett, who's a psychologist that studies these kind of things, he said that what's happening, in his estimation, you know, part of the reason for that is that we are becoming surrounded by signals environment that to make us feel like failures, like triggers to make us feel like failures. Like society is demanding more and more and more of the individual. So, you know, so we are surrounded by these perfect body images. It's harder to get a house. It's harder to get a job. You know, so there are more and more ways in which we can be kind of pushed into feeling like failures. And of course, that has these very significant mental health.
So I only got to page 10 of your book before it says one examination of what both men and women believe it takes to be a man these days found they have to be a fighter, a winner, a provider, a protector, and maintain mastery of control at all times. If you break any of those rules, you're not a man.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I mean, that's one of the things that I found kind of, it's one of those things you find out, you think it's shocking, but also I totally get it.
I got to page 10 and thought, oh, that's how I feel.
That is how you feel, and that is what we're talking about. There's this enormous pressure from all corners to feel increasingly perfect, and that is why the most at-risk group for suicide are middle-aged men, because men have all these, you know, pressures to feel like perfect. I mean, of course, women do too. But when men hit middle age, they tend to, that's when we lose our jobs. That's when we get divorced and lose our children. That's when we start putting on weight and our bodies go. So for middle-aged men, there are lots and lots of kind of risk factors when you get to that age, because you start feeling like a failure. You know, that list of impossible to achieve qualities, it begins to really sort of slip from our grasp, but when we hit middle age.
And I think for you only have to go two more pages on to page number 12 where you find out about women having impossible tasks as well. And I've been saying this for ages, that the way women are marketed to, the TV shows and the magazines, I feel sorry for them, because, and you make this point in your book, they have to be the perfect mother, or they have to want to have a family. They also have to be the perfect person. They've got to be able to go out and party, because that's what modern women do. They've also got to hold down a job as well. And in all this, they've got to be intellectual and everything else. They're looking for the impossible. There's not enough hours in the week for them to achieve everything they want to achieve.
There's that phrase, have it all, you've got to have it all. It's like, no, you can't. Yeah. You can't. You know, I mean, sure, a small fraction of the population are exceptional and can have it all. But to be the perfect mother, the perfect ambitious business person, you know, to look perfect, it's just not possible. And when people don't match up to these ideals, they feel like failures.
And you touched on it a minute ago. Love Island's sort of the pinnacle of it, really, isn't it? Because they, you know, 65,000 men and women apply to go on that show. They still went into nightclubs and stuff to pick people out. They were trying to find, I don't know how many, 10, 20 really good looking guys, 10, 20 really good looking girls. All their bodies are immaculate, you know. And they're putting these people up as sort of normal people, aren't they?
I mean, that's something that I've noticed in my own lifetime. So I'm 42, so very much Gen X. You know, I was the kind of music kid when I was growing up. So I was hanging out in venues, pubs, drinking, taking E's. That's what we were doing as kids. But these days, they're in the gym.
Yeah.
They're not taking E's, they're taking protein bars.
Yeah.
And you, so when you look at Love Island, I mean, those men are gorgeous. I mean, they're stunning looking things. And you just think, God, what an enormous pressure that must be now to be an 18-year-old young man and to be watching Love Island and going, God, I've got to look like that now. So that's a really new thing.
In your book, it says gym membership has risen by 44%. So obviously that's proving that fact. And muscle dysmorphia, which I assume is muscle dysmorphia. You think your muscles are smaller, or you have a problem because you think your muscles aren't big enough.
You have a distorted view of what you actually look. So you look in the mirror and you think, oh, I'm a puny, I'm pathetic, but actually you're quite muscly. But I guess it's related to eating disorder in that way, of people kind of looking in the mirror and having a distorted view of what they're looking like. So before the 1980s, and of course that's a really sort of key time for this story, is 1980. Before then, muscle dysmorphia was this really niche condition that was found in a subset of bodybuilders, and now it's just growing hugely, especially in the States. And the vast majority of sufferers of muscle dysmorphia are, of course, men. And it tallies with the UK statistics that show, when you look at needle exchanges, in the last decade, there's been a 600% increase in men addicted to anabolic steroids.
Wow, so they're trying to get bigger. But there was a bit of a, in the 80s this happened. There was people doing the working out, the muscle thing in the 80s, and it sort of died a bit in the 90s where indie came along. As you were just mentioning, clubs and indie, and people didn't care as much. They were sort of more interested in going out. So it might change.
Yeah, but I think 1980 is a really interesting time, because that's when everything changed. You know, and that's the story that I tell in Selfies, that 1980, that's when we became much more individualist, because it was Reagan and Thatcher's idea of neoliberalism. And what neoliberalism is this idea that we're going to turn the world into just one big competition. So we're going to turn, it's almost like the Hunger Games, we're going to turn human life into this competitive struggle of self versus self. And that means, you know, demolishing the welfare state as much as we can, getting rid of the unions, getting rid of the jobs for life. Everybody's got to be like an individualistic, entrepreneurial center of kind of profit and genius and ambition. And so that's what they did. And it's had a huge impact on who we are. I mean, I think if there's one controlling idea in Selfie, it's that kind of who we are is very much a product of our environment and our economy. And if you think about who we were in 1965 versus who we were in 1985, it's just a transformation. We've gone from these collectively minded hippies, man, you know, don't no sell out, no corporations, all that, you know, all that stuff, to 1985, the complete opposite. And what happened in between those dates, exactly in between those dates, was Thatcher, Reagan, neoliberalism, a new economy, and that changed everything. And you begin to see the results really quickly. So, you know, 1981, Thatcher was saying to the Sunday Times, you know, she's saying, this is quite a chilling quote that I found. She said, the method is economics, but the object is to change the soul. You know, she was saying, I'm going to use economics to change the character of people. And she has done. I mean, look at who we are today. We're all hyper-individualistic kind of neoliberals. And then you see in the data, weird things start happening in the 80s. As you say, the Keep the Fit revolution began. Jim Fix in America, the Green Goddess in the UK. We all started to want to look good. You know, it became massively important. Around 1982, something weird started happening in maternity wards. So for generations, hundreds of years, people had called their children just by standard names, Arthur, Alfred, Jennifer, Elizabeth. And then suddenly in 82, you start getting people naming their children by unusual, kind of very individual names because they want their kind of kids to stand out and be a star is the inference there. And that sort of soars up through the 80s. So that for me, that's the big change that's led to who we are today, is that kind of 1980s.
I'm one of those people, aren't I? Because I obviously was born and thought, I've got to put myself on telly. Obviously, no, I must be. Yeah. One of those people who's so I can blame Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, well, you can, you know, and it's true. I mean, another data point was that beginning in 1980, there's this big surge in people who you ask kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? And celebrity becomes a big one. And that begins to start emerging in the 80s and much more in the 90s too, or post kind of the reality TV kind of thing happening. So yeah, that all starts as well in the 80s.
So in your research for the book, what are we supposed to be? Are we supposed to be collective as a society? Are we supposed to be rather than individual? Are we supposed to be a small part of a whole?
Well, I think it's a matter of nuance. It's a matter of degree. Like, I definitely wouldn't say that individualism is a bad thing, because I think that would be really naive. Individualism, there's lots of bad things about individualism, of course. It creates a society of winners and losers, and that's why we worry about inequality, that's why we worry about, you know, social mobility, and those are completely legitimate worries. But also, look at what we've achieved in the West in the last 2,500 years. We've done lots of bad things, of course, but we've done lots of amazing things. We've built America. You know, we've invented amazing things. And a lot of that is individualism. A lot of that is this pressure on the self. It's that thing that says, you, Tim or whoever, Jane, you can be amazing. You can change the world. You've just got to go for it, shoot for the stars. And that's a really intoxicating message. That's the message of individualism, and it pushes us on to do amazing things. But there's that massive kind of underside to that, and that is that the reality is that most of our lives are kind of full of failure. Even when from the outside, you look like this amazing success, to be inside of that often feels like you're still failing, because that deal didn't come through. Yeah. I didn't get that gig. Here's this other guy that I feel a sense of competition with, and he's got this amazing thing in America now. And so you're constantly feeling like a failure, even when really you're a success. And you know, and when you don't get, and when you fail and fail and fail and fail again, that is the pathway into suicide. That is when they look at people who commit suicide, you know, a big part of one of the kind of commonalities in people that do that is that they have overly high expectations for who they ought to be and for what they ought to achieve, and they repeatedly fail and they feel stuck in their failure. And when you get to feel stuck, then you're in real trouble.
It's funny actually you should say that, because that word winning you keep bringing up has been a constant in my life. I'm over competitive, if there is such a thing, and I've spent the whole of my life like that, and just recently I've started looking at it thinking, this is nonsense. What am I actually winning by wanting to win absolutely everything? And I'm trying my hardest to not stop doing it, but it's very hard. Since I've done that, I've started looking around and noticing that the world is shaped for winners and losers. We spend the whole of our time doing it. Every TV show now is competitive. So you've got The Apprentice or Love Island. You can win in love. No, you can't win. You're either in love or not. You're not going to win love. You know, The Apprentice, you're fired, you win. You know, if you listen to broadcast journalists and stuff, they all talk about winning. You know, it's not about competing, it's about winning constantly. And if you listen to something, the language used, if you listen to some competition like the Olympics, cutthroat, selfish, you know, it's determined. It's kind of these strange words which you would associate, quite bad words, but are associated with winning and being successful and being put on a pedestal.
But this is very much, again, this is individualism too, because it's in the West, this is very much emphasized. So if you look at the East Asia, which is Confucian, which is a very different way of looking at the world, very different culture, where they privilege the group over the individual. There, if you are an individualist kind of person and you're kind of thrusting forward and you always kind of got those sharp elbows, it's seen as a very bad thing. It has much more sort of negative connotations. I mean, in China, shyness is considered a leadership quality. It's quite extraordinary how opposite it is. So, and to kind of stand out above the group is quite a taboo thing. So it's very much, so what you're describing, of course, it's not that cut and dried. There are still East Asian sports stars who are amazing and competitive. But it's very, very emphasized in the West. And it's no accident. It's certainly no accident that, you know, a lot of these competitions trace their way back to the Olympics, which of course is the ancient Greek invention. And ancient Greece is really important. It's absolutely the birthplace of the Western self.
Are you saying there is no self before ancient Greece then? What is the self? What is that?
The self, it's a really good question. The self is, it's just the kind of construct through which we feel alive and to which we feel a kind of a human being. So it's the rules and ideas we have about who we are, where we're going, what life is, you know, that's kind of what we call the self. And so maybe I can explain it better by talking a bit about ancient Greece, because that's, you know, so of course there was a self before ancient Greece, but it was very, very different. And if you think we're talking about 2,500 years ago, so it's a long time ago. So this is really sort of Game of Thrones world we're talking about. But in ancient Greece, something mad happened, something incredible happened. And it happened because of the physical kind of ecology of ancient Greece. So if you look at East Asia, China's the best example. It's the example that the psychologists use. The landscape is rolling plains, low hills. So it's really good terrain for farming. So what they were doing in ancient Greece, they were doing big agricultural projects. So rice farming, big irrigation projects, sort of wheat farming as well. And so to get along and get ahead in ancient Greece, you had to be part of that group, because it's the group that won. The group had to be a coherent, functioning unit to survive, because that's how you're going to get that rice to grow. In ancient Greece, completely the opposite. Ancient Greece is not even a country as we know it today. It was 1,000 individual kind of city-states on islands, little tiny islands on the edges of little sort of rocky pinnacles. And the physical terrain was very rocky. It was all mountains descending to sea and little islands. I mean, I'm sure you've been to Greece. Yeah. That's Greece. So you know Greece. You know, there's no big fields in Greece. So to get along and get ahead in ancient Greece, you had to be an individual. You had to be a hustler. You had to be a trader. You had to be part of create your own tiny industry. Animal hide, olive oil, that kind of thing. And then you had to go out. There was a big fishing culture. So people were out there fishing and they were trade. They started, because it's a very seaward facing place in a particular part on the globe. They started trading with other cultures. So all these new ideas were coming in. Ancient Greece, it's just an isolated landscape. It's a tyranny because it's easy to conquer. No new ideas coming in. But ancient Greece becomes this landscape. The landscape causes you this kind of world of individuals. So from that landscape, and because to get along again, you had to be that hustler, that small business person. It meant people started seeing the world as made up of individual pieces and parts, not as this kind of big connected kind of field of forces. And then so from that you get debate. So debate was like a sport in ancient Greece. People were arguing the toss about stuff. I mean, that was radically new. Competitions, sporting competitions, the Olympics, bull leaping was a big thing. It's the leap bulls. And then the worship of the individual in terms of the physical body. Aristotle came along defined the human being as the kind of political animal. And Aristotle was a guy that he decided that in order to achieve kind of perfection, an individual had to act in a state of ennobled self-love, he called it, which is just the forerunner of the self-esteem movement. So they kind of came up with this idea that a human being is an individual. We're not connected to each other. We're individuals. And, through education and hard work, we could achieve something like perfection. And in fact, that was our duty. That was our kind of fate. We should all be heading towards that kind of state of perfection. And that's who we are today. And it is really who we are today. So when they take people from the West, this is what psychologists do. They study people from the West and study people from East Asia, and they put them in laboratories, and they've got all these different these different kind of crazy scientific tests they do. And one of them involves, all you do is for 3 seconds they show you a video of a fish tank. Mm-hmm. And this fish tank has got this big individual fish at the front, sort of flashy orange fish, you know, like show off kind of fish. And it's sort of surrounded by all the other usual kind of fish tank stuff. And they put these glasses on you and they track your eye movements. And they see somebody from the West just pretty much looks at that fish, and their eye very rarely drifts out of context. But the East Asian eye is constantly moving out between the fish and the context, the fish and the rest of the stuff in the fish tank. So they're much more aware of context, of things being, of the relationship between things. So you take them out of the lab and you say, what did you see? And the Westerner goes, oh, there's a fish, saw a fish, orange fish. And then you ask the East Asian and they go, oh, well, there's a fish tank and there was da 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 da. So they're actually, they're literally seeing a different world. They're experiencing a different world than we are, a much more connected world. And, you know, and one of these psychologists said to me, have you ever seen the average street scene in East Asia? To us, it's chaotic. All the stuff that's going on. I mean, I don't know. I've cycled in Beijing. It's insane cycling in Beijing. It's just like you're surrounded by hundreds of bicycles. But they experience the world as a much more interconnected place than we do. We have a sort of individualist brain. So it's really the depth this stuff goes to is really profound. It's deep, deep, deep.
Is that better?
That is that's such an individualist question. See, that is only a question that a Westerner could ask. Because for a Westerner, there's one answer. The truth is an individual object, right? And it has properties. Is it good or is it bad? That is straight out of ancient Greece, that question. And that's why I love it. So because the truth is an East Asian answer. It's both. It's neither good nor bad. It's just a system. It's just a way of being. And of course, there are lots of really good things about it, but there are also lots of really bad things about it, as we've been talking about. But one of the good things about it versus East Asian is, of course, we know from looking at China that people in China are far more willing to allow an individual to suffer unnecessarily in order to sort of benefit the group. And we call that human rights abuses.
Right.
In East Asia, of course, China, they're far more willing, of course, not to accept it, but they're far more willing to put up with that kind of stuff because they have this inherent understanding of the group being dominant. So, you know, that's our preoccupation with human rights comes from these ideas. But
as part of nature, which I believe we still are, our pursuit is to be the best to survive. Is that right? And as a self, we believe we need to get to the top of the pyramid. We need to get right to the top of the ladder because that's how we'll survive.
Yeah.
And so that's our pursuit, isn't it, in the West?
Well, it's everybody's pursuit, but everybody wants to. So we're a tribal animal. So that's what we are. We're a tribal primate. And that means that we want to do two things, get along with everyone and get ahead. So obviously those two things are in conflict. But every tribe has different rules. Every tribe has slightly different ways in which you get ahead. So in the West, we get ahead by just being those free individual objects pushing our way to the top. But in the East, it's by getting along getting along with everybody else. It's much more about being part of that group.
As humans, though, the one thing we crave is to be in control. Control of ourselves and maybe in control of our environment.
Yeah.
And is that a problem? Is that easier to achieve in the East than the West?
It's such a good question. That's a really interesting question because they've studied this, us versus the East Asians, their sense of control too. And so for people in the West, we have this inherent belief that control is down to the individual. If you want to control your life, you want to control the world, you get out there and do it. You be that hero of that. Of that story. But in East Asia, they have this much more of a sense that the control is in the domain of the group. So they look to the group to kind of maintain control. And again, that's why you see still there's a communist government in China. It's one of the sort of major reasons for that. They naturally feel that they almost sort of subcontract that need to for control out towards the group. And in order to maintain control of themselves, they just... It's about making sure the group's okay. The family unit, the company you're working for, the government. It's about making sure the group is okay. And you see that in stories too. So in our stories, it's all about the individual hero striking out and killing the monster. Yeah. And that's the hero. The hero, you know, selflessly fights the monster and kills the monster. But in East Asian stories, the hero is far more likely to be somebody that sacrifices themselves in order to benefit the group.
Oh.
So even their notion of the nature of heroism is different.
Yeah, okay. How does religion fit into all this? Because I'm someone who grew up without a religion. Mm. So I've not been christened, I have no religion, my parents aren't religious, and I look at religions and I hope I don't offend anyone by saying this, but I look at religion and I think that's really strange because they're based on no proof at all, and yet they're given laws and rules, and I always think it's really quite a strange thing that people go, yeah, all right, I'll do your laws and rules, rather than go, I'm not doing your laws and rules because you've got no proof to it and I'm going to do what I want to do. And I find it strange that people follow someone telling them to do something. But I don't know, how does religion fit in the whole self thing?
So one of the things the self is it's a storyteller. It looks to explain the world using stories. And the kinds of stories that we all have a particular personality. We have a particular kind of set of core traits and responses to the world and feelings about the world. And we'll tend to pick out stories from the environment that suit the feelings that are already there. Of course, it's much less prevalent now, but especially back in the medieval times, in the kind of pre-scientific age, they picked out a story that made sense to how they're already feeling. So to get along and get ahead in England, as it was 1,000 years ago, this was feudal Britain. So this was the lord of the manor. It's much more East Asian, that period of our history. So to get along and get ahead in those days, you had to be subservient. You couldn't put a foot wrong because there was no police force. It was violent. Without the protection of the lord, you had no land, no food, no protection from sort of bandits, etc. So and what do you find? I mean, what I found in that monastery in Glasgow was this absolute fetishization of low self-esteem, which I remember. I'm not religious either, but I was brought up in a very strict Roman Catholic household where it's very much not allowed to be an individual. It's all about, it's this kind of flagellating, self-hatred is sort of in the core of Catholicism. And it was there, there was one thing I read in one of their books that described kind of the virtuous man as experiencing life as if he is a despised worm. I mean, Jesus wept. But what that's doing is that they're telling a story that codifies. It's transmitting a message saying this is who you've got to be to survive. Yeah. Keep your head. I don't know if I can swear on this podcast, but keep your head down. You know, don't put your head above the parapet. You're a despised worm. Be humble, and then you're going to be all right. Because that was life in those days. So. Yeah, and the story made sense to them because you've got this, priest on the pulpit saying, these are the rules to live by, and you live by the rules and it kind of works. And So I think these stories make sense of the kind of chaos that is part of being human. Another way I kind of understand religion is that, imagine you're the kind of archetypal alien just a Stone Age person. Who just looking out into the stars. Religion is a story, but it doesn't just explain why we're here and why the stars are there. It explains, why do I feel lonely? Why do I feel guilt? Why do I feel anger? What should I do when I experience anger? Why do I hate this person? What do I do? What happens when I die? So it's really interesting to me how when confronted with the most kind of profound and powerful questions there are, what the human brain produces is a story. And it's quite an individualist story, especially the New Testament one. It's this guy that comes out of the earth. He's great. He's called Jesus. He has these magic powers, man. And he dies and he gets in it. And then, so it's a story with a hero that goes through trials. It might as well be a J.K. Rowling, the New Testament, in lots of ways. So that's what we do. We tell stories to kind of explain and help us feel control over the kind of chaos and disorder of reality.
So how do we get from ancient Greece to the 1980s? What have we missed any major steps along the way?
Yeah, I think there's a couple which I'll kind of mention sort of briefly. So the first one's obviously the Industrial Revolution. So that happened in the 19th century. So for the first time, because the Industrial Revolution, we were free of that horrible self-lacerating Christian ideas that you've got to keep your head down. Suddenly, there were pretty sexist times. It was only for men, really. But if you worked hard, you could move up. You could become working class. You could move from working class to middle class. And even so, you become rich if you had the wiles. So, and that's when the first book comes out. It's called Self-Help. It's by Samuel Smiles, who is actually weirdly my great-great uncle. He wrote the first ever self-help book. And that was called Self-Help. And that was basically saying, if you work hard, you can you can become rich. And then the next one, which I think was even bigger really for our story, was in America. And that's this guy called Carl Rogers. And he's a very influential psychotherapist. And he had this revolutionary idea. So going back centuries and centuries and centuries and centuries, the core idea of what a human being is, that we are bad. If you strip away the layers of a human, what you'll find inside is something awful. So for Christians, it was original sin. We all have original sin. And, you know, that's it. You know, you're never going to be perfect. For Freud, Sigmund Freud, who's seen in most narratives as the big kind of revolutionary figure, he believed in the Oedipus complex. He believed you had these horrible incestuous desires buried down there. And, you know, but Carl Rogers had the opposite idea. He believed that underneath it all, humans were good. They were really good. And actually, if you strip away the layers, you'll find something amazing there. And that's a revolutionary idea. And that begins this whole era of the human potential movement, which is through the 60s and 70s, where people came up with these ideas. And because it's so California, it all happened in California, that people were amazing. And in order to kind of thrive and to fill our potential, we just had to just believe in our own amazingness. And, you know, at the Esalen Institute, there were these big kind of intense kind of stress sessions, a bit like imagine Big Brother, but you put all these strangers in a room for weeks and weeks and weeks, and they had to be completely honest with each other and authentic. And the idea was that you would sort of bury down and find this kind of perfect core. And from that comes the self-esteem movement of the 1980s. So that was all quite a hippie endeavor during the kind of collective 60s and 70s, when our economy was very collective. So we had high taxation, unionization. It's very collective times, very socialist times, even in America. And then, of course, neoliberalism, the 1980s, it all changes.
Before we go into that, there was a bit in the book, and I can't, because I read it a while ago now, I can't remember where it is, where you have to, excuse my language, everyone, but you make yourself into a prick.
Yeah.
what are you doing there? Because it's a funny bit in the book. I enjoyed it. And there's a woman who's pretending to be a cavewoman at the same time. Explain what that was.
So that was Esalen. So the Esalen Institute is a really amazing place. And it's still there. As I said before, it's where Don Draper ends up at the end of Mad Men. It's a really iconic place. And it became...
This is 1960s.
This is the 60s and 70s, but mostly in the sort of like mid to late 60s was peak craziness. And so it was the kind of the crucible of the human potential ideas. And there were lots of these kind of completely insane therapists who became guru figures there. And one of them was a guy called Fritz Perls. And he was this German guy who used to walk around sort of naked it's not very family friendly, some of the stuff that he got up to. But in his therapy sessions, he'd always accuse people of being fakers. You're being a fake. And, you know, even today we're still obsessed with this idea of you're a faker. You're not authentic. You're not for real. And a lot of that comes from him and come from Esalen. So they kind of fetishize this idea of being real. And so one of the things he'd make you do to kind of help yourself was that he would work out who is the person you really fear you are, and then you'd have to really be that person. You have to become that person and really act it out. So people would end up doing all this kind of crazy stuff. It's called Gestalt therapy. And so I went to Esalen, where they're still doing a course a bit like it's called the Max, which is very sort of heavily inspired by Fritz Perls' ideas. And yeah, so I mean, one of the things that I worry that I am, I'm just a grumpy Englishman. I'm a whinging Pom, you know. I'm your classic Victor Meldrew, you know. Yeah. And of course it worries me. I don't like being that person who, you know, sighs in when the shop queue isn't moving fast enough. And so that was what she told me to do. She said, you've got to be that prick. I said, I've got to be a prick. And she said, yeah, just be that prick. So I thought, okay, I can do that. Yeah. Yeah. It was great because especially in the mornings when I'm feeling really antisocial and then people go, hi, and I just want to go off.
Yeah, but there's this one bit in it which made me laugh, where there was this woman who was, for some reason, I can't remember why, was pretending to be a cavewoman.
Yeah, so her task was to be disgusting, I think, primal.
She was outside a tent, weeing on the floor, and you come out and tell her she's disgusting.
That's it, yeah, yeah. Well, actually, I walked out and she was actually in a tree on a branch, and she was wearing this you know, cavewoman outfits, dressed, you know, kind of made out of ripped rags, and her sort of breast was hanging out, and she had this... and sort of jumped out of the branch and just started urinating in the flower bed. And of course, usually I'd just think, oh my God, that's horrific. But now I was like, yes, I get to say it. And I was like, you are disgusting. And she looks at me and she starts going, because that was her task. She couldn't talk. And I just sort of started laying into her. And it was like intoxicating. I was like, this is amazing. You know, you can see how people do get intoxicated by it. But that's also the dark side as well. You know, it's so interesting how you see where these ideas you know, at the beginning of our talk, I talked about this idea of who we are today and where did it come from. I'm a secret fan of Big Brother. I've been a fan of Big Brother since it began. And one of the tropes you constantly see in Big Brother, and you see it in Love Island too a bit, is this idea of realness, of authenticity. And the worst thing you can be on Big Brother is a fake.
Yeah. Yeah,
you're a game player, you're a fake, you're not being real. And so many of these ideas go back to Esalen and Fritz Perls, and that's very much that thing. And so in that moment, it felt intoxicating. This is who I ought to be, this prick. If I feel like a prick, I should be able to be a prick.
Yeah.
But I don't believe that's true. I don't believe that we should be a prick. You know, when the task ended, I felt quite relieved. Thank God for that, you know, because...
Yeah, anyone who says to you something like "you got to take me for the way I am," you know, what's that expression? What's that expression we talked about the other day on the podcast, Mark? I'm looking over at Mark here, where people say, I say what I see. Yeah. I say what I see. That means you are a prick, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not going to shut up. You're just going to say nonsense to people.
But this is where, you know, you asked before, Tim, about, you know, should we be more collective? This is where I think we should be more collective, because, you know, I worry that when you say collective, we're going to think about you're a communist or you're like a 60s socialist. That's not what I mean. I mean, it's just being aware that we're a tribal species, and that means we are connected. And the things you do have effects. They have ripple effects. So if you are saying what you see, that has ripple effects on other people. And it's not good enough just to turn your back and go, well, I don't take responsibility for any effects that I have in the world.
Right. Well, I've got something on that then. And I wanted to get into the 80s. So remind me to come back to that, because I think it's important. But I want to cut to the chase now talk about it. Because one of the big things that I've thought for a long time is everyone's really anti-Donald Trump. And I like to see positives in things. And I think the positive side of Donald Trump, and this is just my theory, is he's king of the narcissists. And I think we live in a really narcissistic world, and it doesn't seem to be changing at the moment. People are self-obsessed. Society seems to have broken down, where people don't particularly care for each other. And people are trying their hardest to pretend to care for each other at the moment. I'm not sure they do. But Donald Trump has got to the top of the ladder. He's the leader of the free world, and he's for all intents and purposes, a narcissist. And he's there at the top. And you're looking at the biggest sporting event of, I don't know, of the year will be McGregor versus Mayweather. And the way they're behaving at each other, their aggression and their, look at me, I'm brilliant, one throwing money at the other one and the other one going, I'm the best. And it's just, it's become so vulgar, our world, that have we reached tipping point now? And that, a wave of empathy is going to come through, and people are going to start saying, oh, come on, let's build society back together. It can't get worse than we are at the moment.
I think we are at the beginning of this tipping point. And the kind of profound irony of it is, I think it's that Trump is the beginning of that tipping point. So what you see as you go through the 80s and right through the neoliberal era, especially ironically after the financial crisis of 2008, is a rise in this idea that government should be run more like businesses. And you see that on the left and on the right, political scientists say that that's not just a right-wing thing, it's a left-wing thing too. And then surprise, surprise, out of the reality TV era, you get this arch-businessman, Donald Trump, is elected. And it's a strange idea, that, because historically, and I would argue correctly, government isn't, you know, is a collective endeavour. We look to government to look after us, to take care for us. It's not... shouldn't necessarily be run like a business.
Yeah.
So Donald Trump comes along, but what does he say? Like, what are his campaign messages? His campaign messages are: I'm going to build a wall with Mexico. I'm going to force Apple to put an iPhone factory in Wisconsin. Basically, it's jobs, jobs, jobs. It's anti-globalization. Now, globalization is is the neoliberal project. The neoliberals' sort of wet dream is to have the whole globe as this one perfect, unfettered market where everybody can trade with each other without barriers. And of course, that means immigration. So if you've got a right-wing brain and you're looking at the problem of our hyper-competitive, individualistic neoliberal society, you're going to focus on one thing, and that's probably immigration, because that's where your right-wing brain takes you. That's your diagnosis for the problem. And so that's what you do. And that's what we saw, this big vote for Donald Trump. And with Brexit, if you sort of read All Out War, the books about Brexit, what the people behind the Brexit campaign said was what won that for us was immigration. It was this threat of people like Turkey joining the EU and all the Turks coming to the UK. So on the left, we go, oh, well, that's racist. But I don't think it is necessarily. Of course, I think it's impossible to tear the two things apart. But it's also an argument against globalization, which is a part of neoliberalism. Now, you're seeing it on the left as well. the big Corbyn surge that nobody saw coming, you know, recently. That, if you have a left-wing brain and you're looking at exactly the same problem, you're not going to be worrying about the immigrants because you like immigrants, because you're high in the trait of openness, you like novelty, you like all that stuff. What you're going to be looking at is things like deregulation, you know, regulation of banks and businesses, you know, all the kind of neoliberal pursuit of freeing industry from what its responsibilities for us in order to make as much money as possible. And that's what Corbyn's arguing for, a kind of return to this kind of much more kind of pre-neoliberal era. So I think what you're seeing on the left and on the right is the beginning of a massive rebellion against this idea of neoliberalism. It's just that they're manifesting in very different ways. But I really do believe that Corbyn and Trump are connected. It's just that they've both identified a problem, which is neoliberalism stroke globalization, but they're just arguing about how to change it in different ways. So it seems to me inevitable that it's going to change because they both want it changing.
Do you think the Trump phenomenons are positive for the world?
Not right now, because I think the problem with Trump is that he wasn't telling the truth. He got into power on this protectionist anti-globalization stance.
I mean, by the way, positive as in the results, not as in what he's doing now. I mean, as in, will we look at that and go, we can't let that happen again? Someone rise that way without maybe getting too political.
I think it'll be positive what I hope is that the center left will understand that what worries me about the whole thing is there's still this myopic idea in the left that Trump rose because everybody's racist and misogynist. It's just not true. I mean, of course, that's part of the story, but that's not the part. But there's another part of the story that's not going to get you anywhere, hating on the right like that. What's going to get you somewhere is a look at the other reasons. He was arguing against neoliberalism. I mean, Hillary Clinton during that campaign doing a massive paid speech to Goldman Sachs. That's all you need to know. I mean, she's neoliberal to the core. And I think the center left and center right need to come up with a vision for the future that somehow marries the best of neoliberalism and globalization, but brings back a lot more of the protection.
Just define neoliberalism?
Well, it's this idea that all of human life should be a competition. It's self versus self. So take away all that regulation on banking and business. Take away their responsibilities for us. Let them do what they want. It was neoliberalism that led to the global financial crisis. It was deregulation of the banks. Let them behave how they want, the banks. No rules. Mm. And so it's these ideas that has kind of led to all this chaos. And one of those sort of no rules things is no rules in immigration or not as many. And that's of course a problem for people on the right.
Right. Okay. The one thing that I think connects them all, and something that you've mentioned there, is whenever I've always found this a problem. Whenever politicians stand up, whether it be Theresa May, Jeremy Corbyn, Trump, anyone, they go, "I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that," and I'm thinking, "What, on your own? You're going to run a whole country?" Yeah. And I've just always thought, wouldn't it be better if one of them said, "We are going to be looking at the, I don't know, we're going to be looking at the energy system. We're going to be looking at reforming the schooling system," or "we," and you think, "Oh, there's a lot of them doing it. Brilliant." But they're not allowed to do that, are they? They're obviously being told, "You're a leader. You've got to say I, because we want someone strong up there." I don't want anyone strong. I want someone who's looking around for people to help them.
That's it. I mean, I agree. I mean, it's not something I'd notice, but I'm sure it's true. And I'll be interested to know if you compare the I statements of Western politicians to the statements of Eastern politicians. I'm sure they'd be
that'd
more
be interesting, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. But don't forget as well, when I mean, you're probably similar age to me, when Tony Blair came in, for years he was, people complained that he was this kind of, they called him a focus group guy with no ideology. He was just trying to sound out what people wanted. And actually, in retrospect, that was pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, let's look at, I said we'd go back to the 80s, because this is where it all started, you say, the sort of phenomenon of neoliberalism. That's where it all started.
Yes. Yeah.
How was it invented again?
So, it comes out of this guy called Friedrich Hayek, who's this very interesting sort of Austrian economist. I mean, it's various people, but he's the kind of guy that's known as the Godfather. And it was quite interesting because it comes out of a really good place. He was Austrian, and he saw the Second World War, and he was like, "How can we stop this happening again? You know, how can we stop? How did Austria fall to the Nazis, and how can we stop communism?" And he said, "What those two things have got in common is that they've got the state controlling everything, and particularly they're controlling the economy. And if you control the economy, you control everything. So what we need to do to free people from these horrible ideologies, communism, fascism, is to reduce the influence of politics and let the markets look after themselves, let the money look after itself. So get rid of all the rules and all the kind of oversight on the markets and let the markets run free. And so then that was seen as an insane idea for decades. For all through the 60s and 70s, it was almost like a taboo idea, but it was kept alive by these very powerful businessmen and thinkers in sort of various think tanks. And then in the 1970s, everything went mad. All the economy went completely to boot. And so politicians had to cast about for a new idea. What are we going to do? And neoliberalism was the idea that Thatcher and Reagan decided to put into action. And, you know, as I say in the book, you can't demonize neoliberalism. It did take us out of the economic case of the 70s. Millions of us have got a lot wealthier as a result of neoliberalism. Globalization, which of course, as I said, is that neoliberal project. Globalization is the idea that the whole world is one market, like one unfettered market. That has lifted millions of people out of poverty in the third world, in Asia. It's done immeasurable good out in the world. So you can't just demonize neoliberalism. It's a system. It has lots of good things and lots of bad things. But of course, it changed who we are. And out of that, is sort of really the heart of the book is this idea of the self-esteem movement, I think, that comes out of that. So this guy, John Vasconcellos, that I write a lot about in the book, he's this Californian politician, and he was at Esalen. So he had a nervous breakdown in the 70s, Catholic guy, was always taught never to privilege the eye. It was all about God and never put yourself forward. Massive nervous breakdown in the 30s, went mad. And then discovered Carl Rogers, this guy who decided that humans were amazing, discovered Esalen, went to workshop after workshop at Esalen, and just he felt that this was the answer. But what's really interesting is that in the 60s and 70s, this is much more of a hippie kind of idea. You know, humans, we're amazing, man, we're all connected, man. But after neoliberalism, it becomes something different, a harder idea. And what Vasco thought was that if you give everybody high self-esteem, make them believe they're amazing, they'll be just better players in the competitive game. You know, not only will it get rid of drug abuse and domestic violence and homelessness, all these ideas, but it would also make us more competitive people. So he believed that was the solution, and he really believed this. And at the time, in the middle of the 80s, everybody thought he was nuts. Like, everybody outside California thought he was an idiot. But he was the second most powerful politician in California, so he was unable to get big funding for this three-year task force, and he promised the legislature, which is, you know, their, I guess, the equivalent of the parliament, that he would prove that self-esteem was what he called a social vaccine. It was literally a medicine that was going to cure us of all our problems.
Wow.
And he was going to prove it scientifically, that there was a causative effect. That's really important. It causes it. So you give a kid high self-esteem and it causes them to be amazing. So he does that. So he spends, you know, 1986, the task force is launched. He's a joke. He's literally a joke, this guy. Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show is doing, you know, root sets, making fun out of him. There's a cartoonist called Gary Trudeau who does these syndicated cartoons that go all across the United States. He does a 2-week run of cartoons exclusively devoted to making fun of Vasco and his thing. So this is awful for Vasco. So he undertakes this task, and then 3 years later, lo and behold, as if by magic, he announces to the world, the results are in. We have got 7 professors from the University of California system, very esteemed professors, and they have shown that self-esteem is a social vaccine. It's true. So the idea goes around the world. It's picked up by the world's press. He's on Oprah Winfrey show. He's a star, and the self-esteem idea goes viral. It goes everywhere. He's even invited the Soviet Union to speak to the communist government about self-esteem.
But this is us telling our children.
Yeah,
this is what it results in. Telling our children.
It changed the way we raise our kids. So from there on in, we started. The idea was that if you raise your kids to believe they're amazing, protect them from failure. Don't let them become like, you know, if they come last in the race, give them a rosette. Tell them they're amazing anyway. So there's an the era of grade inflation in schools. There was this amazing incident in the UK where a teacher stood up at the a teaching conference and said, "It's not grade inflation, it's grade encouragement." You know, it's this idea that nobody's allowed to fail. But what happens, unfortunately, is that it creates a generation of narcissists.
Yeah.
So what you see in the data is that as soon as Vasco's task force, you know, says that we've proved it and the idea goes around the world, rates of narcissism begin to kind of wobble a bit in young people. And then a couple of years later, this starts going up, and it goes up and up and up and up through the 90s, through the kind of noughties, and up into this decade too. And so. You've created this kind of, this is the millennial generation. And indeed, there was an interesting study a couple of years ago that the University of Amsterdam did, a really, really intensive study where they took 500 families and studied them for a space of 2 years, and they rated how the family were raising their kids, and they rated the kids' narcissism, and they found that what they called it parental overpraise. The parents that raised their kids with parental overpraise, they saw every 6 months that kid's levels of narcissism would go up and up and up and up. And what I do in the book actually is I spent a year investigating this self-esteem task force, and I tell the story. Actually, I tracked down a renegade member of that task force, because I noticed that he didn't sign the report. It's 25 members of this task force, and that report that says yes, it's true, is a blank space above his name. So I went to his house in San Diego, and he said the task force, the whole thing, he said it was an effing, he didn't say effing, but he said it was an effing lie. The whole thing was based on a lie. And in fact, the professors didn't say that you're right. The professor said, you're wrong. There's no evidence for what you're saying. And he said, I was there. He said, I was sitting three seats away from Vasconcelos when he saw that data for the first time. And he said, if the legislature see what's in these reports, they're going to take away our funding. And from that moment on, it all starts getting swept under the carpet. So that's what to me is amazing, that this idea that changed us in the West and helped create the millennial generation is all based on a lie from this one guy.
So I think what people don't understand is you're not born a narcissist. Narcissists are created, aren't they? And they're created by giving them, either by ignoring them and treating children badly, or by giving them huge praise all the time. That's where you create a narcissist, isn't it? And that's kind of where we've got to. Is it an epidemic stage now? Narcissists all over the world running things.
I don't. Well, I mean, so the scientists who did this work, had a book called The Narcissism Epidemic. I don't know if you can call it an epidemic,
right?
But the reason why you can't goes back to your question about that's how do you raise a narcissist? But to understand that, you've got to understand where I end up within the book, and that's that we are all. So we all have certain personalities. Mm-hmm. We're all born with a certain personality traits in place, and events in our childhood serve to either lessen or magnify those traits that we're born with. So I was brought up to believe that I have low self-esteem and this can be cured just by believing in myself. What I find out is that I am actually high in the trait of neuroticism, and there's not much I can do about that. That's just who I am. So what the ramification of this is that certain kinds of children are going to be much more vulnerable to parental overpraise. And these are children with two particular traits. One is their low in agreeableness. So they're competitive. They don't play well with other people particularly. And the other one is they're high in extroversion. So they kind of crave attention. They crave kind of reflected glory. So those kinds of people are going to be particularly vulnerable to those effects. And that's why I wouldn't call it an epidemic. I think amongst that subset of kids, it is an epidemic, undoubtedly. But globally, there's a huge amount of people that aren't going to be vulnerable to these effects.
But we're worshipping them.
Yeah.
Well, the great stars have had to fight to get to it. The great sports people, the President of the United States, maybe Margaret Thatcher. I don't know who, but we worship all the people.
Absolutely.
The ones who are narcissistic and cutthroat and get to the
top.
They're
the heroes of our culture. Yeah. And they're the heroes of our culture for a very particular reason. So the heroes that we hail, and the heroes of our stories, of our kind of culture, are the ones who are best designed to get along and get ahead in our particular tribe. And our tribe right now is neoliberal. So to get along and get ahead, you've got to be narcissistic a bit. You've got to be self-forward. You've got to look great. You've got to push yourself forward. You've got to have them sharp elbows. You've got to be a hustler, right? So to get along and get ahead in our neoliberal tribe, which is where we're living, you've got to be this particular kind of person. And that is why we hail them as heroes, because that is cultural propaganda. It's our culture saying this is who you ought to be. You've got to be 23, thin.
Yeah.
You know.
So should we be putting our children through this, or should we change?
No, I think, I mean, that's where I end up within the book, actually. It's that we need to understand these ideas. There's two really essential ideas. One is this is cultural propaganda. This isn't the truth. Our culture is saying this is the ideal self because it wants us to get, it wants us to thrive. But it's not the truth, you know, that a person actually isn't a very nice person. It's not a very happy person, is it? It's you know, really fundamentally. But the other core idea is that we have these core personality traits. There's not much we can do to change ourselves. There's a big lie at the heart of our culture. And that lie says you can do anything you want to do and be anything you want to be. You've just got to go for it. I mean, you're from a sports background, Tim. I mean, this message is completely immersed in sports culture. Just go for it.
Yeah.
And it's not true. Of course, we want to be encouraged to be the best we can possibly be, but we are all biologically limited. We can't all be David Beckham or Wayne Rooney. We can't all be Beyonce. It's not true that we can be whoever we want to be or do whatever we want to do. That's a lie, because we are biologically limited. So it's the understanding that the perfection in that way is not possible. You know, of course, we should be encouraged to really butt up against the edges of our potential, but we're sold a lie that we can become this premiership footballer just if we try hard enough. It's not true.
10,000 hours, apparently.
Well, that's not true either.
Why? You think that's not true?
Well, I mean, I think the guy who... Well, the 10,000 hours thing, Malcolm Gladwell was a really smart guy who wrote that book.
Yep.
And I think he was frustrated because he got lots of pushback saying it's not true. But actually, if you read his book, he admits it's not true.
Right.
And the guy who did that study also, I've interviewed the scientist, and he said, no. It's also biologically, if you have the kind of biological stuff in place to become amazing and you do 10,000 hours, you'll be amazing at that thing. But if I spent 10,000 hours playing football, I promise you, Tim, I would not be very good at football.
You look at the background, though, to a lot of sports people, and say the Williams sister, the dad watches TV. I've read that in Malcolm Gladwell's book, by the way, so I don't know how true this is, but the dad watches TV, says, I'm going to make Wimbledon champions or tennis champions, takes them out, and then just makes them hit balls for hours upon hours upon hours, creating these sort of champions. But what are they going through to achieve that? The dad, you've got to ask questions about him and his mentality. They're not sitting watching Hong Kong Phooey. They're out.
Well, that's it.
Where I got Hong Kong Phooey, I don't know.
So what we don't see is the dads who are undoubtedly out there, who are putting their daughters and their sons through that and are not becoming Serena and Venus Williams.
Yes, golf and tennis and is very prolific in that.
But
and
also,
football.
I would put money on the fact that that dad and probably the Williamses and Sue are low in the trait of agreeableness, because that corresponds with being competitive, and so you have to have that in place, as well as all the, I don't know, what's the kind of perfect genotype to play great tennis. There'll be a kind of preferred, all kinds of complex things, lung capacity. I mean, you know, the list is endless. So there's so much biology underpinning all this success too. It's not simply 10,000 hours.
It's strange because you look at, let's go to tennis. Djokovic was taken away from his hometown, wasn't he, at a very young age, and put in tennis camps and stuff. But there's obviously parental guidance behind all that. The parents have got to be involved in it somehow to do that, to achieve.
And of course, genetics are hereditary, so there'll be some sharing of that thing. And again, there's zillions of kids who are put in the same tennis schools who don't achieve these things.
Exactly right.
And also the other thing is perseverance is a trait as well. So there are lots of kids that will be pushed as hard as Michael Jackson was pushed or the Williamses were pushed, and they'd break down. Yeah. They wouldn't cope with it. They would crumble. Yeah. And those kids had the strength, the resilience to do that, and a lot of that is you're born with that. You've either got it or you're not.
You talk about the East. In China, they were only allowed one child for a long time, and apparently this is created, I read on the internet, so it must be true, it's creating a whole generation of narcissists, because those children are worshipped and they wanted sons generally, and so they sort of worship these men. Is this true? Did you manage to see anything about that? Or
I don't know about a generation of, I think what's happening in the East at the moment is quite interesting, because obviously in China's an odd case, because we look at China and we think of Beijing and Shanghai and Chengdu, but it's actually a massively rural place, so it's still very Confucian. The really interesting place in East Asia is South Korea, because South Korea is the most westernized East Asian country, so they still have all their Confucian ideals. So you've got to be a great son or a great daughter, you've got to make your parents proud, so that means working really insanely hard at school and getting to those top universities to please your family. But they also have all the individualist pressures in South Korea, because they've adopted all these Western value system very much, and so you've got to be kind of flashy and bling and all those things that we have in the West. And so what do you find? What's the result of having both Confucian pressures and East Asian pressures at once? The result is they have the second highest suicide rate in the world. I mean, it's miserable. Right. You don't want to be a kid growing up in South Korea. It's miserable. So there's lots going on.
So where are we at the moment then? I mean, are you happy, Will?
I'm happy for having kind of read this book, as cheesy as that sounds, because I think for a long time I struggled with not meeting. I felt a great distance from that image of the perfect self.
I've got to say, if you are suffering sad moments in your life. I don't want to go as far to say this is a cure for depression, but if you are worrying who you are and having thoughts about it, this book is brilliant on that, because you do start working out who you are from it. And it's quite interesting because it's a long story to get where we are, and we have been told lies all the way. And as I said to you, the reason I'm on TV is because of the 80s, and I've read it in your book, and that's what I was individual. I was going to be better than anyone else, and this is what I was told, and I achieved the dream. Whether that made me happy or not is very arguable. Mark's shaking his head dramatically there, violently shaking his head. Mark knows me very well, and it's true. I probably have, I do definitely have some very dark times. The book is very helpful. It's really interesting book to work out where you come from. Sorry. So, where are we at the moment?
Yeah. So I was just talking about the kind of the journey that I took, really. And for a long time, I used to, up until very recently, was to beat myself up, because it would be like, you know what? You'd look at telly and you'd see like friends. Like, where are all my friends? Where are the people that I go to dinner with? And I don't have any. My wife would have the same problems. And I felt there was something fundamentally wrong with me for a long time. And I used to write articles about this. And I used to beat myself up. And then when I found out about this personality psychology stuff, and I did my little test, and I found out that I'm high in neuroticism, and I'm low in extroversion, so I'm an introvert. And introverts are very happy in their own company. They don't need friends. So it's like, I don't beat myself up for it anymore. I'm very, very happy
Right. Pootering
around on my own. And whereas I used to feel, because I wasn't like that Love Island guy, that there was something wrong with me, that I was a faulty human being. And now when you find out the truth, and especially because it's science, it's not like reading some weird self-help thing by some, self-appointed person. It's inarguably true that we are born particular traits, and we are who we are, and we're all different. You really begin to understand in a profound way that there is no such thing as perfection, and moreover, you should not beat yourself up for not being that.
And social media is killing us, because rather than hearing about a party you missed out on, it's every day, all day, you're hearing about what you're missing out on, isn't it?
Yeah, it's relentless. It is. And it is. It's like that for everybody. Whether you're like a 14-year-old girl flicking through pictures of Emily, whatever her name is, I can never pronounce her surname, gorgeous Emily, with things.
I don't know.
Or like Kim Kardashian and going, I'm never going to look like that. Or whether you're me, a middle-aged writer who's follows lots of other writers and seeing their amazing success and going, oh, you're like stabbing that love heart button going, I hate you. It's just that pressure. You're constantly having other people's perfect moments paraded in front of you. And that's one of the fundamental ways the human self works. One of the ways we all judge how we're doing in life is that we compare ourselves to the people around us. You can't get out of that. That's how it works. So that's one of the ways that social media is very damaging for us, because it's constantly punching us in the face.
And it's fake. And this is the new world we live in. I talk about Donald Trump again. He's preaching fake news all the time. He's preaching fake everything. Everything's fake. Pictures are fake. They're going to be able to, they change words. They're fake. News is fake. They're going to be able to very soon change the way that you speak. So I can take your words on this podcast and change them. I think you can pretty much do that now. We're soon not going to know what's real and what's not. And this could be quite an issue for us. Everything is fake now.
Yeah, we
don't know what's
quite
real.
Shocking. Yeah, I suppose I would just go back into my tribe as journalist in my original tribe and just say it's just I think we need to start paying for our news a bit more, because.
But it's tough being a journalist, because it can be. You're peddling a lot of fake news, aren't they? The journalistic industry journalism. I don't know what I'm trying to say
from my perspective, a lot of it's because, down to the internet. I think the internet has been a disaster because it rather than relying on print advertising and just pure money for buying the thing for profits, now newspapers, even serious ones, rely on clicks. And to get clicks you need outrage, and to make outrage you need to tell half the story. So we're getting, even in good newspapers, we're getting half the story now.
I know this is going on a long time, but I think it's worth it. Just to want to quickly touch on going into ourselves, the fact that we're now looking to more spiritualism, more sort of meditation. Where does that fit into the equation?
That comes through. That's another big thing that Esalen pioneered. So back in the 60s, we were, as I said, we were a much more collective culture. it was actually amazingly kind of socialist time. There was high taxations, as high as 90%, even in America, unionization. It was the era of kind of corporation man, revolutionary road, suburbia. And those, that generation gave birth to the hippies. So around this time, we were much more open, we were much more communitarian people, much less individualist. And that meant that these Eastern ideas, which seemed so exotic and foreign for so long, suddenly made sense to us in a really profound way. We could get them in a way which we never could get them before. And so at Esalen, that's when it starts happening. So Esalen pioneered this idea of God is within us. God isn't a person living in the clouds. God is within us. Forget all those books, forget the Bible and the Quran. God's within us. And in order to kind of nurture that God, you need to do some self-work. So the idea of meditation, massage, yoga, all of that stuff as ways of looking after and caring and kind of purifying yourself in a non-religious way. That was Esalen. And that's a massive, massive thing that happened. And that was in sort of in the late 60s. And that's when it starts coming in to the Western culture. So you know, it starts being very upper
middle. It seems to be really big again now, though.
Yeah, it is. I think a lot of that is to do with, I mean, one of the people I talk to in here who talks about the neoliberal self argues that a lot of that is down to neoliberalism because, again, culture is always trying to push us into being the most ideal version of a person who can get along and get ahead in our particular environment. And the person who needs to get along and get ahead in neoliberalism in this era, late neoliberalism, is somebody that's fit and healthy, because you've got to be, because if you're sick, you're not going to get much sick pay. And if you break your leg, you know, yeah. Or, you know, you, there are not a lot of protections out there for people. So you've got to be fit and healthy. So there's a huge pressure on people to kind of look after themselves and keep fit and healthy, because that's how you're going to survive. And so I think that's a lot of what's going on as well.
So what is the solution then? You say we're miserable. You say that a lot of people having suicidal thoughts. What is your solution to it?
I would love, especially in schools, I would just love there to be a general sort of re-education, just a bit of a kind of grounding, kind of basic education on what a human being is, because we are brought up to believe that humans are as gods. You know, we can do whatever we want to do. We're amazing. We're miraculous. And we're not. We're animals. We're literally apes. We're not like apes. We are literally apes. Like, we're kind of smart apes, but we're still apes, and we are biologically limited all in different ways. And so there has to be balance. I don't want to crush anyone's dreams. Like, if you want to be an amazing footballer, go for it. But there needs to be that moderation in there, that understanding that you are not a god, that you are only a human, you're a mush of biological stuff, and that you are limited in certain ways. So rather than people being encouraged to go for whatever dream that happens to pop into their head, find out what you're good at and go for that. And if it turns out you're not good at that, have the courage and have the kind of support of the people around you to move into something else. Otherwise, you're going to be miserable. You're going to be really unhappy.
And I've got three daughters. What should I say to them on a regular basis? Because I always tell them, oh, you're great. Yeah, the classics. The classics. What should I be doing?
That's a good question, because I don't have kids. I guess it's just that you're only human. I mean, you know, it kind of seems banal, but, like, you know, that they are... It's a question of encouraging them and rewarding for trying hard rather than trying anything. You know, if they try something and they're terrible at it, and you think privately, oh God, they're terrible at that, then steer them away, because that way lies misery. There's a guy in the book called Brian Little, who's a very famous personality psychologist, and he talks about this idea of personal projects. We all have personal projects that we're undergoing in our lives, and in order to make us happy, they've got to have two qualities. They've got to be meaningful in some, so it could be important to us, that kind of goes without saying, but we have to have efficacy over them. And by that he means we have to be somewhat good at them. So there's no point trying to be a Premiership footballer if you're terrible at football.
Yeah.
It's just, and there's a lot of people out there. I mean, you've only got to watch X Factor, the audition stages, to see the amount of kids who go in there convinced they're the next Mariah Carey. And that's the whole comedy.
I'm not sure getting to the top of anything's a particularly good thing, because once you've got to the top, the people who get to the top of that sort of certain personality, once you drop off the other end, you're defined by that, and you spend a lot of your time feeling probably quite miserable. Say, let's just take football, for instance. You're the brilliant footballer. The country loves you. You retire, and then for that very short period of time, you're that brilliant person, and then you have to live out the majority of your life, maybe another 60 years, being the guy who used to be the brilliant footballer.
Awful. I mean, in fact, I only mentioned...
Depression's huge in sport, by the way, in retirement.
There's a footballer, actually, he's an Australian professional footballer. I mentioned him briefly in there, but I wrote a big piece about him in Australia when I was living there for GQ, and he had that exact story, a big star. It's called Ben something, and he had to leave the game because of injury. He damaged his neck, and he became suicidal because for precisely those reasons.
Yeah. We ask everyone who comes, I know this podcast is going long, guys, but I just think it's worth it because I think it's really important that it's an explanation of who you are when you're sitting here listening to this. And we'll put a lot of work into it. As I say, 3 years into this book, it's not just one of these, because a lot of people, I think a lot of these books and a lot of self-help books, no disrespect to any of the authors out there, they can bang them out in 6 months, can't they? They're basically what they've done.
That's true.
And I do think this, I think they write two chapters and then pad it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think that happens a lot. This book's really worth a read because it tells you who you are and why you think the way you think. But we asked four questions to all the experts who come on here. So I'm going to do this as well with you. What advice were you given that has been invaluable to your life? This could be in work or it could be based on the stuff from your book.
Well, for me, I had an editor. I used to work at a magazine called Arena, if you remember Arena magazine, but I used to work there. And I'm terrible in offices because of my low in agreeableness, low introversion. I'm a grumpy loner, not good for offices. And I was always falling out of people. And he said to me, the one thing you got to do, Will, is you just keep the emotion out of it. And I always remember that because I didn't know of a way of doing conflict without pissing people.
Doesn't matter,
guys. Pissing people off.
Yeah.
I couldn't work out what I was doing wrong. And he had it there. Take the emotion out of it. And it was revolutionary for me because then I realized, oh, I can disagree with people, but you can do it in such a way that you don't make an enemy of them. And it's just about keeping the emotion out of it. So that's a really important one for me.
Because that seems to be all the flavor in journalism at the moment, doesn't it?
Yeah,
people sticking their emotions in and
it creates outrage and it creates enemies and you don't want those things.
Yeah, but it also creates headlines.
Yeah.
What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that can help them?
I guess it's what I was saying before. Understand that you are kind of limited. Understand that this version of you that you are kind of paraded with, that you kind of dream of becoming, it's a mirage. You're never, you know, it's unlikely that you're going to get there. And stop beating yourself up just for being you.
Okay. What mistake do people make? I've got maybe doing your job or just in life that you know.
What mistake do people make doing my job?
Well, or just in life general, whichever way you want to do it.
I think the big thing, especially for people doing my job, but in life generally, is they don't understand that we live our lives in story mode, that we live our lives as if we're the hero of the story of our lives. And that means that we only kind of tend to accept ideas that flatter our own kind of heroic narratives. And that means that we make enemies of people who simply disagree with us. And I see that, especially in my profession. Now, if somebody comes at a problem from a place you don't approve of, it's not just that they have a different perspective. They're bad. They're evil. And that's a trick the brain plays on you. It's not the truth. Everyone feels like they're doing the right thing. Everyone's just trying to get by. And I think that's the big mistake. It's assigning kind of moral judgment on disagreement.
Well, I think there's so much at the moment in conflicts throughout the world. Both sides think they're right. You've got to understand that the other side, for some bizarre reason, whatever it is, thinks it's right. And when you've got politics, like for instance, Brexit at the moment, I mean, I won't bother getting involved in discussing what I think, but both sides are being so rude about the other side.
And
it's like both sides think they're right.
In psychology, they call it naive realism. And it's the idea that we naively think that reality, everybody sees reality as we do. And if you say, to us, reality is obvious. It's obvious that Brexit is right or wrong. And that means that if other people disagree with us, because it's obvious, it must mean they're evil. They're either stupid or they're trying to destroy the world. That's what happens. And this is just how the brain works. This gives us self-esteem, that idea. It makes us feel like we're right.
Yeah.
And it's a trap. It's a trap and it's a dangerous trap.
And no more so than social media, which is, you know, the whole selfie thing is where it's so prevalent at the moment, where people have dug in and on Twitter and Facebook and everywhere, they've dug in their trenches on their side and they're trying to find as many enemies as possible whilst finding as many allies as well to try and make their case. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, you're all actually really nice people. Can't you just have a chat about it?
Well, that's it. I mean, it's really interesting because, you know, we haven't talked about it, but that sort of briefly goes into that idea that we're tribal animals and being tribal apes means that we live in groups and out groups. And like our relatives, chimpanzees, we are driven to attack other groups if we see they're not conforming to our norms, you know, violently attack. Like a chimpanzee will rip the arms off of a chimpanzee of a different group. And you see that absolutely, social media is pure tribal. It's us being chimps. It's us ripping the arms off people who are not conforming to the codes of our own, you know, tribe. Yeah.
And finally, any life hacks, Will?
Yeah, I've got a very basic life hack.
Go on.
And it blew my mind. And it sounds very mundane, but I guarantee a lot of your listeners don't know. Did you know that you can get a rail card even if you're a normal person? You don't have to be old or young. A normal man or woman can get a rail card that gets you 30% off all your rail travel.
No, I didn't know that.
You just get it. It costs £10 a year, and that's it. I feel like... because they never advertise it. In the Southeast, it's called the Network Rail Card. And every time I tell people like that, they're really pleased and they get one. And then they're really angry because they think, I've spent years
travelling around,
ripped off. And I could have saved thousands. So check out the Network Rail Card. A third off all your rail travel.
Well, that's
big life hack.
That's the best life hack we've ever had. Listen, your book, Selfie, How We Became So Self-Obsessed and What It's Doing to Us, is out now. When's it coming out in paperback?
Oh, I don't know yet. It'll be next year. Spring next year, I think.
Get it now. I promise you, it's a really good read. It's fascinating stuff, and a lot of research has gone into it. If people want to follow you on Twitter, what's your Twitter handle?
At WStore, STORR.
And are you on Facebook or anything else?
Not
you doing
on Facebook.
Any of that? So that's where
no.
to follow you.
Yeah,
okay.
Just Twitter.
And what's your next project?
I'm actually writing a book next about the science of storytelling. Which is a bit more of a sort of, yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, come back on and talk to us about that. Thanks a lot, Will. Great conversation that with Will Storr, and I'm looking at myself in the cover of his book, which is all reflective there. This podcast is brought to you by Cooker, spelt Cooker, pronounced Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water directly to your kitchen tap. It does hot water, it does cold water, it does 100 degree boiling hot water, and it does cold filtered water. I love my Cooker. I thoroughly recommend them. I think I've had one for years now, actually. I can't imagine not having it. That sounds really poncy and showbiz and TV Tim, but I just can't imagine having a kettle. Just, you know.
You can't imagine having a kettle.
Hold on, let me try it. It's gone. It's gone.
But I mean, I can
try my hardest.
Yeah, I can understand you saying I can't imagine not having a roof on my house. But
I can imagine that. I just can't. I can't remember what a kettle looks like. I did like kettles, but I just, you know, I like living in the future, which is where I'm based now. I'm based in the future.
and funny enough, you're always going there.
I'm in the future every day. The next day, I'm always in the future. I'm always looking and I'm thinking I'm in the future. Anyway, that's we've also... thank Beer 52, who I want to advertise on our podcast, which is great. They bring us beer from all over the world in a the world's leading
beer.
World's leading, what is it called?
Beer.
Beer.
Discovery.
That's
club.
That's the word I'm looking for. Beer Discovery Club. They bring you beer from all over the world.
It's great, actually. And if you want to get a free case of the beer, just pay the postage of $5.95. And they'll send you a case of 8 beers with a snack and a magazine. You go to beer52.com/lovejoy to claim your free case. You can cancel the subscription at any time. And if you like the beers that you get there, you can go and buy them. You can go and buy a case of the ones that you really, really like.
It's fantastic. You can open it up and sometimes there'll be Skull, sometimes there'll be Hofmeister in there. Sometimes there'll be Orangey Boom. It's a lager, not a tune. There'll be...
I mean, obviously Tim's talking out of his stupid ass because they don't do those sort of beers. They do very nice craft ales.
Heineken in there sometimes.
He's always trying to derail me when I'm doing this.
Michelob.
But what I do is I just carry on while he's talking.
I remember the other day.
So what they do is they do some really good craft ales from around the world. So we had some from Europe. We've had some from Korea. We've had some from the US, and they're always really interesting and always really very different to the ones that you would probably get anywhere else, I would say.
Oh, how excited I was when there was Coors Lager there the other day.
And
it's Coors Light.
There was one time when we were doing the podcast and we were about to do the read for Beer 52, and it turned up And
Corona is there.
I mean, it was just so exciting because it came in. It was like Christmas. And we just opened it straight up. Nice. And normally, because it comes from a delivery van, it's actually kind of chilled already. So it was really nice. So no, I recommend this.
Heineken, haven't I? Can of Heineken. They arrive sometimes. But it's when Skull turns up. That's when everyone gets excited. And they open their box. Sometimes, like 1 month, I'm just hoping I can. I'm just thinking about this, trying to imagine kettles. I'm desperately trying to imagine that 1 week. Turn me up, don't turn me down. I'm trying to imagine a whole box.
That was the Dear Love Joy podcast. If you would like to email us, it's dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com or Tim's at Twitter @TimLovejoy. That's it all from me and Tim. He's never speaking again on this podcast. So for the time being, I suppose I better say it. Peace and love, Joy.
Peace and love, Joy.
Bye.